This podcast is brought to you by Preacher Clothes in a Box. Are you a preacher who gave up on your wardrobe the first year you went to seminary? Are the few young people remaining in your church looking at you as if you just crawled out of a Barty Miller rerun? It's time to stop worrying about your look and try Preacher's Clothes in a Box. When you try Preacher's Clothes in a Box, our experts will talk with you to discover your particular style and all of the practices of self-care you have neglected. Your personal expert will consider your level of burnout and the years left until you can retire, and then pick out the perfect wardrobe for you. Each month, you'll receive a box containing a new outfit for you to incorporate into your weekly wardrobe. Your expert will choose from the following looks for even the most style-challenged minister, such as the hipster pastor. We will send you a pair of faded and ripped jeans and a $300 t-shirt so you can overcompensate just like the hippest megachurch pastor. Regardless of whether you wear glasses or not, you'll be given a pair of Warby Parker knockoff glasses so you look smart. This carefully cultivated outfit will show that you are just too cool to care about your look, even though superficiality is all you really care about. Or maybe you'd prefer the burnt-out pastor. A pair of worn khakis and threadbare button-down Oxford shirt, complete with lots of wrinkles and set-in stains from eating fast food drive-thru in your car. This monthly outfit comes in sizes XL and double XL, and we can special order triple XL because of all the weight you've gained sitting around contemplating what went wrong in your life decisions. Or maybe you'd like the CEO pastor. We will either send you a three-piece suit with overpriced dress shirt and a tie that costs more than your car, along with ridiculous cufflinks that make you look like a 1980s junk bond trader. Or we could send you a black turtleneck and jeans to look like Steve Jobs when he unveiled the first iPhone. Either way, you will walk into your next church council meeting looking like you are a take-charge kind of guy who isn't going to take any more crap from Ed Turner, who always mouths off about the thermostat settings during Sunday morning worship. Female preachers also have some great choices from Preacher Clothes in a Box, like New Age Mama. We'll send you a flowing muumuu that disguises how much you really weigh and that resembles a Walmart shower curtain. You'll match it with knockoff Birkenstocks and some kind of necklace that is sure to draw comments and lots of attention. Like a necklace of wooden animals you got on a mission trip to Africa. A necklace of crystals you purchased from the spiritual director on your last spiritual retreat to a day spa in Asheville, North Carolina. Or a necklace of various world religious symbols purchased from that Unitarian jeweler hawking his wares at a recent interfaith women's gathering. Or maybe you'd prefer the patriotic pantsuit. We can make you look like one of those female Pentecostal megachurch pastors who advises the president on spiritual matters. You can look like you are in charge and that you love America, with our coordinated separates in various red, white, and blue prints. When you sound off with some nut job idea about God rejoicing at the caged-up immigrant children, you'll be sure to take in the donations. We haven't forgot youth ministers. Whether you are male or female, Preacher Clothes in a Box has the outfit for you. You will show the elders of your church that you are keeping it real no matter what they say when we send you a t-shirt with an ironic print on the front demonstrating you are up on the latest pop culture memes, but you still love Jesus. Our selections of earrings suitable for placement in your ears, eyebrows, and lips will show the teens just how edgy you are. We'll even include a voucher for you to get a tattoo at a nearby tattoo parlor. You can choose between a gothic cross or a crown of thorns to show that you are not only radically cool, but radically sold out for Christ. Stop worrying about how your congregation judges you and how you look, and let Preacher Clothes in a Box make you into the preacher you want to be, or at least the preacher you can't help but be. Hey Hey, Save Me podcast listeners, this is Chase Peoples, host and creator of the Save Me podcast, where a failed minister considers the decline of American Christianity. Let's see, how have I failed as a minister this week? Well, I didn't put out a video of a sermon that looked as good as a TED Talk professionally produced or anything like that. I did not attract a ton of new members to the church I'm serving based on my charisma alone. I wasn't a very good administrator and did not reorganize my church's leadership structure for the 21st century. I did not come up with some new mission project that I can put on my website to prove that my church gets it. I wasn't contacted by any media outlets to talk about ministering during the coronavirus. I didn't do anything this week to make me better thought of by my peers or to add to my resume. Just another week where I did not win the ministry game. But maybe that's okay. I'm pretty sure Jesus did not do any of these things either. I still need somebody to save me from my growing midlife crisis and the voice in my head that says you didn't have any fun in the first half of your life. So buying a sports car, leaving your family, and dating someone half your age all seem like reasonable next steps. Definitely need some saving. I also this week need somebody to save me from the insane people out there protesting to open up the economy. Man, press reports keep showing up that these groups are funded by some of the same organizations that funded the Tea Party a while back. And now, as if that wasn't bad enough, white supremacists are joining in to make common cause with people who just love to hate the government. Looking at those pictures of protesters carrying machine guns and screaming in the faces of cops with nothing happening to them, it makes sense. What I see that black folks are tweeting online, making the point once again that black people could never get away with that kind of thing. Remember, everyone, as you consider all these white people in camos and guns in state capitals, that it was no less than Ronald Reagan himself who signed gun control into law when he was governor of California because the Black Panthers carried guns at the state capitol back then. Nothing like a bunch of black people with guns to make white people vote for gun control. But I guess our culture will never do it if it's white people. Sure, carry a bazooka. You need it for self-protection. The Constitution wants you to have it. It makes America a better place. Meanwhile, that hottie Justin Trudeau up in Canada just passed a law banning assault weapons. Canada looking better and better. And if that wasn't all bad enough, all the crazy protesters with the guns getting all the press coverage, folks striking at hospitals because they don't have PPP, people striking at Amazon and Whole Foods and Instacart because they are working in unsafe working conditions. Man, they can't get screen time. I think even if they did murder people, they wouldn't get the press because the white, crazy people with machine guns make too sensational of a story. Look, I get it. You don't want to wear a mask? Fine. But if you don't want to wear a mask, you aren't just making a decision for yourself, but also everybody you breathe on, spit on, yell at, and sing in the general direction of. I just don't get it. I mean, I really need somebody to save me from it. I realize that there has always been a strain in America that hates whoever they want to label as elitist. But when did we start thinking that people who are brilliant experts in their fields were somehow elitist and should be disregarded? I don't want to believe that it's just because I'm a liberal that I want to hear from an expert scientist on viruses about a deadly virus that we spread without knowing, and I want to hear from them first before I make any kind of decision. I didn't know that was a partisan thing. I thought it was just common sense. I don't know. Am I a liberal snowflake? What is wrong with me? This week, I finished up my second week as an interim minister. As far as I can tell, I haven't been too reactionary and venting my pain from what happened at my last church unfairly upon them. The folks in this church I've been able to meet in person or in Zoom meetings seem great, and it's also interesting. It's a congregation I would describe as a little more back towards the middle theologically than the far left of my last congregation and a good portion of the people in my church before that who were way over on the left. I found it sort of refreshing to talk about Jesus Christ and not to have to make a disclaimer for half the congregation that's Unitarian or just basically agnostic, but showing up to church anyway. I never judged that part of my church. In fact, I sort of took pride in that the church I was serving had such a large spectrum of belief within it. But in this current context, it's a lot less work in the sense that I can just express my belief that is my own, and I don't make it for anyone else, that Jesus is divine. I don't have to worry about half the room bristling at that comment. I'm also discovering that people in this church actually want to talk about how their faith impacts their everyday life, which I have to admit was kind of a shock. You know, a nice shock, because there was a time in my life where when people talk like that, I would only roll my eyes and want to make a gagging motion. I grew up hearing all that kind of evangelical talk about what God's doing in my life, and it was nonstop. Rarely, if ever, had any kind of intellectual rigor being applied to it, very little reason. Just sort of a nonstop ignorance blamed upon God. And all that sort of talk left me so hungry for a deeper understanding of thinking about God in the world, in the universe, and wanting to ask the sort of questions and express the sort of doubts that the people I grew up with, not only could they not have handled it, but they would have judged it and told me I wasn't a real Christian and was bound for hell and stuff like that. And so in a lot of ways, it was refreshing to serve in more liberal churches and to feel like no question was off limits and nobody was judging me. But I have to say, especially in my last church experience, that I discovered the downside to hanging around a bunch of liberals because, like a lot of things among white liberals, faith became no more than an intellectual exercise, something to discuss, think about, but in terms of it really demanding much of you in your life, in terms of it actually changing you, transforming you, laying a claim to you, being a higher power that you needed to respond to, something more than just what you could put together in your mind in a rational sort of way. Faith wasn't anything more than that. And so I'm finding it refreshing. And I'm just sort of glad in this setting that people want to talk about their faith at all. And they seem, you know, very open. They may not be using the kind of language that I've grown used to or that I find most comfortable, using the sort of authors or writers that mean a lot to me. I found folks quoting, you know, authors and stuff that I've dismissed over my journey. Maybe one good thing about the struggles I've had in recent months is that I've learned some more humility, and I'm learning, I think, to just appreciate that, hey, you know, if they're reading Max Lucado or looking at something from they downloaded from some megachurch pastor somewhere, at least they're searching, at least they're looking, at least they're thinking about what their faith means, about what God wants of them in their daily life. And I have to say, sadly, that that's a lot more than what I've known among a whole lot of the white liberal Christians I've known. Look, I've still got baggage ringing around in my head and my heart. I know it because, I mean, it's like my subconscious right now is still working through what's happened to me. I keep having dreams about folks from my last church, the ones who held secret meetings and manipulated things to get rid of me in sort of unguarded moments in the shower or when I'm putting clothes on in the morning. It's like when your mind's occupied and suddenly you can think about something. I'm thinking about all that. And it's like my subconscious is trying to process it, that me being back in a church right now has triggered a lot of it and my brain has got stuff going on. clearly, as I said, I've got stuff to work through. Well, speaking of me sharing that I've been employed, I'm not sure that I should have shared that on the podcast. You know, 2 weeks ago, before I had this gig, I had count them four people listening to the podcast who became financial supporters of it and chose to make monthly pledges to it. And then on the last episode, I say, hey, I've got a job, and then nothing. No supporters are popping up that are new, and I should have milked the unemployed minister struggling with his vocation a lot longer. I mean, don't get me wrong, I'm still struggling with my vocation. I'm working at the moment, but, you know, this gig's supposed to last until the end of the year, and I have no idea what's after that. Don't know if I'm meant to be a minister anymore. When I shared something on Facebook about going back to work in a church, man, I got a ton of people congratulating me on it. And so many people saying things like, you're back where you should be, behind the pulpit, and where you were meant to be, and stuff like that. And I know they all mean it in the best sense. A lot of them are people from previous churches who have apparently appreciated what I've offered as a minister. But I don't know. For me, I'm glad to have the work. I'm glad it's apparently in a good church. I'm hoping I can offer something to them that God will work through me for them. But in terms of all the questions I have, all the angst I have, all the uncertainty I have about where I'm headed and whether I even want to be in church work, all that's still there. And so the congratulations didn't seem to fit because I was sort of thinking, yeah, I have employment, but I have not figured out what's going on in my life right now. And I really don't know where God's leading me next. But anyway, how's that for laying on the angst and making you feel like you want to support this podcast? Well, if you want to kick some money my way to help me keep this going, I've got some bills to pay for some of the equipment I have bought. I'm hoping to be able to pay for a website one of these days to put stuff up there. But in the meantime, you can go to the site that's hosting and putting up the podcast for me. And here's the URL. It is anchor, anchor.fm/save-me-podcast. I really should have thought about all those dashes. That's a mouthful. But anchor.fm, don't go to anchor.com or anchor.net. I don't know where that will send you. But anchor.fm/save-me-podcast, there's a button there if you want to be a supporter. Speaking of supporters, I am speaking to you on what is a fairly expensive microphone sent to me by Jimmy Haas of Astoria, Queens, New York. Jimmy, an accomplished musician, a bass player extraordinaire, had a mic just sitting around in a closet, he said, and he FedExed it to me. And I saw him post on social media recently that his new band has a new EP coming out, and it's going to release their first single on Spotify and iTunes on May 25th. The band name is Mr. Eyeballs. That's right, Mr. Eyeballs. I don't know where people get their band names, but hey, that one is memorable. Jimmy's last band he was in, up when he was at Berklee School of Music in Boston, was a ska band, which apparently got a following in Boston. Now he's down in NYC, and he tells me this band is more garage band, punk rock sort of stylings. So look for Mr. Eyeballs on your Spotify or iTunes starting May 25th. Also, remember, follow the Save Me podcast page on Facebook. And look for the show on Twitter. My handle is at SaveMePodcast1, the number one. On this episode of Save Me, I'm excited. I've begun some new things I've had in the works the last few weeks. I'm hoping this sort of stuff will be regular parts of my show. First of all, I'm going to start running a short segment. I will have a haiku poem written by the Reverend Aaron Rollerson. Aaron's a friend of mine going back to college who happens to be an Episcopal priest down in Alabama. And as part of his daily spiritual work, he writes haikus and sometimes posts them on Facebook. He's been so supportive of me on the show, and I found his poems actually quite meaningful. I had the idea of including the haikus as a segment on the show every week. So when you hear his voice, I want you just to picture a very tall, very big, broad-chested, and incredibly hairy Episcopal priest reading Japanese poetry. Aaron's nickname in college was Sasquatch because he, well, resembles one. Number two coming up on the show, we're going to have a short essay read by Colleen Brown only. Colleen, a friend living in New York, is married to another friend of mine, Jimmy Brown only. I knew them both way back in college days, back where I attended in East Tennessee, where Jimmy and Colleen were both fresh seminary grads. Jimmy was on the campus ministry staff, and Colleen ran a homeless shelter that was sponsored by the college. She has a great sense of humor, and I love her writing. And, you know, it was amazing when some years later I ended up working at a church on Long Island where Jimmy was the minister and Colleen was there also and their family. Colleen is a seminary grad who also has an MSW, so don't let her minister's wife shtick fool you too much. But she happens to be a great writer, and I think you'll like it. I love her writing so much that I even tried on her behalf to submit it to some publishers, but apparently I don't know how to do that because I didn't get anything back. But I do think it's that good. I think she has a voice that deserves to be heard, and I don't have that big of a following on the podcast, but at least I can share it with you, the tens of you, even dozens of you who have been listening. She has a collection of essays on what it's like being a minister's wife that I think are poignant and really funny. It reveals a part of a minister's life which most people never think about, their family. And what does it mean when one of the parents, one of the spouses is a minister? So even if you're a minister or you have a minister who is female and who has a husband or has a same gender spouse, I still think that you'll be able to relate to what Colleen offers in her writing. And finally, I have an interview with John Singletary. He is the Dean of the School of Social Work at Baylor University in Waco, Texas. I recorded this interview off of Skype, so the audio isn't great. You'll hear my voice really loud and John's voice quieter, but I did my best to keep my mouth shut so you can tune in to what John is saying. The audio isn't great. Like I said, I'm still figuring out things like this and how to record phone calls. John and I go way back to seminary days, and the reason I ended up making him my first interview is because recently I finally got around to figuring out what my Enneagram number is. I've been avoiding this because I've sort of viewed all the clergy who are so into their Enneagram numbers as sort of a cult. That's right, a cult with its own language and symbols and everything. And I'm just contrary enough, which basically means I'm masking my insecurity with just being difficult, that I want to just flip the bird and say, if everybody else is doing it, I'm not going to do it, even if it might help me. Well, I finally got around to taking a test recently, and again, I guess I've been humbled enough in recent life, I'll do anything to help me try to figure out my life. Well, John has done a lot of work and study about the Enneagram stuff. He leads workshops, etc., has a website, teaches people about it. And so I just thought, hey, who better to ask and talk about that? John and I talked for so long that I'm going to make it a two-part interview. It'll be continued on next week's episode. In today's part, we talk mainly about his journey, but take note, Enneagram enthusiast. I begin by stating my genuine amazement at his accomplishments and also my bitter jealousy that he has accomplished so much and we're the same age. But John admits he is an Enneagram 3, a type which works hard to achieve great things so that they can feel worthy of being loved. And at midlife, he is working hard to try and accept that he is worth loving because he is a child of God and for no other reason. And he doesn't need a good resume to be loved. And so if you know Enneagram stuff, you can be tuned in to how the conversation goes. I naturally was falling under the spell of his Enneagram 3 and may have been all the years I've known him. On next week's episode, we will get into the nitty-gritty of the Enneagram, and we will talk numbers and where the Enneagram comes from and why it is a demonic non-Christian tool that all of the books about it should be burned. But this week, he and I sort of think through his journey, and I'm one who's convinced that every person's story is amazing in its own way, and that we all have incredible stuff we survive and overcome and work through. And I think John's journey has a lot to offer for those who care to listen to it. I'll warn you that John and I both come out of Baptist life, of the Southern Baptist variety. And I left that world back in seminary days, back when I still thought I would always be a Baptist. If there was anybody whom I thought was on a trajectory to fly away from the Baptist bubble and never come back, it would have been John. But ironically, out of all people, John ended up back at Baylor, a Baptist university, some say the Baptist university in Texas, a large state full of Baptists. That's where he did his undergrad. And somehow he's made peace with remaining a Baptist, which is still hard for me to believe that anybody can do. I mean, if you had known John back in seminary when we were together, he was the guy dressing in 90s alternative clothes with all sorts of piercings and tattoos before that was de rigueur and only really far out people had them. John was very strident in his liberal social and political beliefs and would let you know it. Like I said, if there was anybody who I thought was destined not to remain Baptist, it would have been him. So I apologize if you didn't grow up in that world, because we name drop some professors and others who Baptists out of that world would know. One name I should explain to you that is important to his journey is that of Diana Garland. Diana Garland was the dean at the Baylor School of Social Work who preceded John. She really took John under her wing and mentored him and helped him along the way, basically to be her successor. Garland, in certain circles of Baptist life, is a hero because in the days of the Southern Baptist Convention battles, she was the dean of what was then the Carver School of Social Work at Southern Baptist Theological Seminary in Louisville, Kentucky. When the fundamentalists took over the convention, the denomination, the first places they went to were the Southern Baptist seminaries, where they purged anything and everything and everyone whom did not toe their fundamentalist line. And so they had no room for associating ministry with that liberal social work stuff. It all was moved to Baylor, where it exists today. But believe it or not, once upon a time, Southern Baptists, at least some of them, actually cared about things like class, race, gender, and poverty. John is still carrying that flame down at Baylor, and I'm glad he's there. I'm glad he's there to ask questions, push the envelope down there, because somebody needs to, and talk about how he gets away with that at a Texas Baptist school. Fair warning, if you are easily offended by curse words, John and I both use them in this interview. I'm still figuring out the podcast thing. No idea how to bleep curse words. I guess I could have edited them out, but that makes more work. And to be honest, I kind of like to cuss. And so if you're listening along with children or you have ears sensitive to such things, be warned that curse words are coming and they may upset your sensibilities. Listen, thanks for listening. I'm doing this podcast for me, but it does bring me a lot of comfort that there are people out there that maybe resonate with whatever I'm going through or saying enough to actually listen to it. It is gratifying and I feel less alone. So I get to look at the statistics every day of seeing that number go up, 1, 2, 3 people who have listened to a podcast in that day. And it does make me feel good that maybe something I'm putting out there in the world matters, or at least resonates with other people. Speaking of resonating, I forgot in all my plugs and stuff about social media that, hey, if you listen to this podcast on iTunes, write a review, will ya? And 5-star reviews are the best, and apparently that's what helps you get noticed. And I guess I want to be noticed. I guess. I noticed that the last person who did a 5-star review of me chose to remain anonymous, and that is perfectly understandable. If I were you, I wouldn't want to be associated with this podcast either. I am up to 4, count them, 4 5-star reviews. I feel like Steve Martin in that scene on The Jerk when the phone book arrives and he looks up and finds his name in it and he says, "The phone books are here, the phone books are here, I am somebody." Well, that's how I feel. Every time somebody listens to the podcast or gives me a good review on iTunes, I feel like I am somebody. You are helping me fill the hole of validation inside of myself that I know I should let God fill and be filling on my own, but I'm having trouble with that. So in the meantime, I appreciate your help. Just a reminder that I'm not anybody important. I'm not anyone you should take too seriously. I'm not an expert on anything. I haven't written anything of note, and I'm just a middle-aged guy who's been a minister, and I wonder even how good I've been at that. But I'm doing a podcast. I need to be saved from a lot, and that's why I called this podcast to save me. I'm doing my best to learn that failing at ministry, at least the way American Christianity understands ministry, may not be a bad thing after all. Remember, if you're looking for somebody to save you, don't look at me, because I'm looking for somebody to save me too. This podcast is brought to you by Crokesbury Books online bookstore. Are you a dying mainline church in need of transformation without your members having to sacrifice anything or change anything about the way they've done church for the last 75 years? Then Crokesbury Books is the online bookstore for you. Now that your church building is empty due to the pandemic, it's the perfect time to start a new ministry, the church library. You might be saying to yourself, why would we need a church library when everyone is accessing faith resources over the internet? Wouldn't it be inconvenient for people to drive to the church building to pick up a book that they could easily get from the public library or download from Amazon? Well, you clearly haven't seen the exciting ministry of a church library. Crokesbury Church Library in a Trunk will transform your Sunday school classroom that nobody uses anymore into an exciting church library that no one will use in the future. We will send you 72 foot lockers left behind by summer Bible campers who were too full of their mountaintop experiences to bother packing up their stuff at the end of the week. The trunks will be full of books for your new church library ministry. Open up your pile of sweaty, sock-smelling footlockers, and you will find things like an incomplete set of the Left Behind End Times fiction series by Tim LaHaye and Jerry B. Jenkins. It's incomplete because Y2K happened, and the Rapture didn't, so somebody just stopped buying the last two titles. 6 to 8 copies of The Purpose-Driven Life that were given as gifts to people who never read them, but who couldn't bring themselves to throw them away. Several books of Great Games for Young People from the 1950s, complete with illustrations depicting only white teenagers who look like members of the Aryan youth movement. A complete set of the 1974 World Book Encyclopedia that Mrs. Turner held onto until her adult children made her move into an assisted living center. Mrs. Turner would not let go of this World Book set because she had such fond memories of her children using them for school reports, and they might need them again someday. And she only agreed to let go of the set when one of her middle-aged children suggested giving it to the church library. Numerous books on theology and the Bible left behind by a former pastor. He never read these assigned texts in seminary, never preached or taught from them, and nobody in your church will ever make use of them. Dozens of books bemoaning the decline of the mainline Protestant church with promises that their author knew just what to do to save the church as we know it in 12 easy steps that somehow never stopped the decline of moderate to liberal American churches in reality. Finally, a set of Time Life books once advertised on TV. It might be the Old West set, or the set on the Civil War, or maybe the battles of the Pacific in World War II, or perhaps these great 50 states. Somebody went to the trouble to buy the whole set, and by God, the church better appreciate this significant contribution. Act now, and Crokesbury will even include a retired school librarian from the 1960s who is back from the dead and ready to scold your church members on Sunday mornings for their overdue books. Order these books now at crokesbury.edu via our online Bible College bookstore website. We are glad to send you ebooks if you are afraid of catching the coronavirus from your UPS man. Remember, if it's a UPS woman, don't answer the door. She's just some feminist out to prove that women can do what only men should do, and will instruct your wife on how to resist graciously submitting to the man as head of the household. And remember, by ebooks, we mean the texts of books downloaded to Palm Pilots with cracked screens, styluses not included, that we will duct tape together so you don't lose them, because each Palm Pilot only has 500 kilobytes of memory that will only contain about a single chapter of a book. These ebooks will come packed in boxes that will carefully protect them from further damage. Because for packing materials, we have used leftover Furbies that no longer speak, which we have picked up at the Alabama portion of the world's largest garage sale running up Highway 127 through six states for nearly 700 miles. It's also a great place to sell your books from your church library that nobody has used in decades, by the way. Try Crokesbury today.
A haiku from your priest, poet, and friend, Father Aaron. Let me hold this space, that peace, quiet, prayer, solace may crowd out the noise.
But still not in good with God. In the beginning, there was God. Then came churches and ministers and people married to ministers. In this holy succession, I fall in the latter category. I've always been drawn to God, though behold, it ran not in my family. While my parents and brothers spent Sunday mornings reading the Star Telegram, I attended church. I repeated on Wednesdays with Bible study and church supper. During my experimental college years, I taught Sunday school and served as a summer missionary, and my master's degree is from a theological seminary. Side note, my children often opt for the more orthodox approach of resisting all worship of God. Everything skippeth a generation. Given my divine resume, you might guess I'd become a minister, but I took the easy way out and just married one. It's easier because I don't have to talk to people in a caring manner. Yes, my husband and I met in a world religions class discussion group. If only every couple met in such a romantic way. We've been married for more than 25 years, and I'm pretty sure all the years count, despite celebrating one anniversary in a Chick-fil-A. I, for one, keep the magic alive every Sunday when our church takes attendance, what they call signing the registry. In addition to signing my name, I always check the box labeled Requests a Visit from the Minister. I also draw a little heart. Bam! An alibi and a romantic gesture. The minister educates, inspires, and comforts our congregation. My duties are more prosaic. It's my job to worry that the minister will screw up and get fired, because then we'll have to find new jobs, new schools, move out of the parsonage, and buy a house. Even worse, I worry that when I stand up during services to sing the doxology, my skirt will hike up in the back. That is not well with my soul. I'm the minister's wife. I may as well embrace it, because no matter where I work, what I say or do, this is what I'm known for. This is what makes the impression, especially in our Roman Catholic town where married clergy are not the norm. Years ago, the teacher I work alongside threatened to quit after learning that the minister's wife was slated as her partner. This is one of the many reasons we became friends. I'd feel the same way. I mean, who wants to work with the minister's wife? It sounds so bad. Of course, people who know me see beyond the stereotype. My friends and family don't apologize when they curse or confess how long it's been since they attended services. They don't complain about their own churches, then ask me why mine is better. And they know I gag when people philosophize that everything happens for a reason. My friends and family see me for who I am, a bright and shining monument to what humanity can achieve should it choose to stay in pajamas all day long. Surely, this is what God intends.
Oh, thank you.
Yay!
This podcast is sponsored by Jonas Nightingale's Holy Spirit Healing Gel. Since the appearance of that satanic Chinese virus on our nation's blessed shores, we have washed our hands until they are raw. Don't get us started on Purell. More like pure hell. Am I right? Give your hands a break and soothe your troubled soul with the latest ministry of the Jonas Nightingale Healing Ministries International Holy Spirit Healing Gel. Jonas Nightingale, the world's leading faith healer, anointed by God to heal the sick and demonstrate the power of the Holy Spirit, has been led by God to present to you who have been afflicted by demonic hand sanitizers that do not yet recognize the majesty of God, the Holy Spirit Healing Gel. One night, God led Brother Jonas to mix together some glycerin and water. The Holy Spirit laid upon his heart to add the scent of citrus to demonstrate this anointed product demonstrates the good fruits of the Spirit. No alcohol was added, because we all know alcohol is of the devil, and after all, Jesus really drank grape juice and not wine as we know it today. Thus, Jonas Nightingale breathed his healing breath upon the gel, and the Lord transformed it into the Holy Spirit healing gel we are offering today. You may be saying, our church can't open back up. We have too many members who are old and might get sick of the coronavirus. Well, with Jonas Nightingale's Holy Spirit healing gel, your old people can get back to praising Jesus and booing the devil as quickly as you want them to. By the way, this may be a good time for your church to take advantage of another ministry offered by Jonas Nightingale Ministries International, the Jonas Nightingale Ministries Estate Planning Kit. Make sure your old people, who are soon to receive their heavenly reward, give your church its earthly reward from their estate plans. Just remember, only 50% of every estate goes to further the international healing ministries of Jonas Nightingale Ministries International. Just the way the beloved saints of your church would want it. So open your church back up in confidence of God's hedge of protection around your congregation with Jonas Nightingale's Holy Spirit Healing Gel, because wearing masks is for sissies who like to kill unborn babies, want to take away your guns, and wish to institute Sharia law under that Antichrist Barack Hussein Obama. Jonas Nightingale Ministries denies the claims that the citrus smell in its Holy Spirit healing gel comes from chopped up pieces of gator gum. I just had a middle-aged moment where I was sitting here thinking, holy shit, it's been a long time since I've talked to John Singletary.
That is so
long,
true.
Long time. And God. I was looking up your bio. Did you really accept your job at Baylor in 2003?
Yeah.
Wow. John, within 5 years
of like graduating seminary. Well, you didn't graduate in 98. In 5 years of me graduating seminary, you got like your combined MDiv, MSW, and your PhD, and you began working at Baylor. That's incredible.
Well, we Enneagram 3s don't mess around.
Apparently.
We got goals.
Apparently. Well,
it's kind of a problem.
The bitter, jealous animal inside my gut is like twisting up right now going, he accomplished more 17 years ago than I ever have and may ever will. Wow, that is.
That's such bull.
That is amazing.
You're a more genuine person than I am. You might not know your Enneagram number yet, but you are more authentic and genuine than I ever will.
And well, how are things in Waco these days? Are people taking it seriously or are they blowing it off?
Man, are you kidding? Our economy is opening fully this weekend. Our governor could not be more excited about businesses back. We're right up there with Georgia in terms of, you know, this disease has had its time in the sun, and now the Texas economy is coming back.
But aren't they keeping up social distancing rules and stuff, like in restaurants, or is it just wide open?
No, okay. They are. Supposedly, most people don't care.
Right.
We've been pretty strict about it. We have not let our kids do much of anything. We haven't gone much of anywhere. I'm just enough of a germaphobe.
Yeah.
I don't have that much anxiety in general around these kinds of things. I'm not really an anxious person, but I am an anti-sick kind of person. I mean, I'm not a fan of diseases.
Well, I saw, I guess, a Facebook post of yours or something somewhere where you were talking about feeling anxious about it or something like that. Maybe that was that was just a put on for your post.
No, that was a rare moment of, you know, I really am anxious. I don't carry anxiety a lot. I don't feel it that often, but this is a season where it's been harder to deny it.
Sure.
I mean, it has been real and I feel it in my body.
So what does that look like? How does that come out of you? What do you like when you feel that way?
Yelling at my children more than usual. Shorter with Wendy than usual. And just jittery. I mean, so as of three, I'm a go, go, go kind of person. I always want to be accomplishing something, achieving a goal, doing something. And it's hard for me to know why I do that. And it's hard for me to know how to turn it off. And the anxiety just kind of exacerbates it. It's like I have to work even harder to prove my worth or to overcome whatever is happening. And it's not even tied to the anxiety. I mean, you know, it's just my anxiety just makes me compulsive in some ways.
Mm-hmm.
So I really have tried to just make myself stop. I mean, I wrote something else I think you commented on, or maybe not, but just about trying to be intentional about slowing down and breathing.
Yeah.
And that's not something I do well. That's something Jason Hobbs tried to teach me 20 years ago when we were in Richmond, about the value of mindfulness and breathing. And of course, Dr. Henson as well tried to teach us all to be that way in the world.
Yeah.
I'm not a contemplative. It's not my way of being in the world. But this is really, I mean, I'm here. I'm not going anywhere. I'm sitting around. There's only so much I can do for my job. Mm-hmm. And so I've decided, okay, I'm gonna just sit and breathe, sit with my breath, and pay attention to the fact that I'm kind of an anxious mess.
I'm not either, by the way. It's never come easy to me. I'm always glad when I become disciplined and then I slack off and don't.
Yes.
Keep
yes.
it going and then feel bad about it later.
Right.
You know, so. Well, all right. Here's a question I have for you. You're my first like podcast interview. All right.
Wow.
When you were 13 year old John Singletary, could you have any idea that you would grow up and be dean of the School of Social Work at Baylor University? Was there anything like in you in that, like at that point, that could have been an indicator this is where you would end up?
No, heavens. I was not a high academic achieving student. I mean, heavens, that was true even at seminary. I've always been good at shortcuts that make me accomplish what I need to accomplish, but I'm not committed to doing the hard work in a traditional way when it comes to these kinds of things. So I always had big goals. Like I wanted to make a name for myself, you know, not necessarily for genuine reasons or truly spiritual reasons. I just always wanted to be the center of attention. Always was kind of caught up with how do I get people to pay attention to me. You know, I cared way too much about popularity. I mean, most 13-year-olds do to a degree, but but then there are those that just don't. And I always kind of envied that. And so sometimes I would pretend to be that way, but it was not it was not my true self. My true self was, hey, pay attention to me, people. I mean, I thought I would be a doctor. I mean, that's how I thought I would get attention. It's not that I cared about doing the hard work of studying medicine. I mean, I did want to help people. I had enough of a sense of my faith to want to do something for good. And I thought about medicine, and Baylor had a good pre-med program. So by the time I figured out maybe I would go to Baylor, I did start as pre-med, but never thought about being, never would have thought I would do what I'm doing now.
You grew up Southern Baptist in Texas.
Yes.
What would you describe, how would you describe your religious upbringing and your family?
Southern Baptist life was all I knew. Well, no, that's not true. We lived in Louisiana for a while. So I knew, I was surrounded by friends who were Catholic.
You were aware Catholics existed, okay?
Yes, exactly. That's it. That's all I knew, was that they existed. That's exactly right. I didn't know the first thing about Catholicism or what it meant, except that it wasn't a good thing. Being Baptist was a good thing. being Catholic was not. And they weren't Christians and we were. And that was kind of, that framed everything. We had it all figured out. We had the right beliefs. We worshiped the right way. They were those ritualistic people. They were the ones that didn't really love Jesus as much as they loved Mary. Didn't know the Bible like we did.
We had priesthood of the believers. They followed the Pope, you know, all that. I always understood that, like, there were gradations, like Methodists and maybe like, you know, disciples or, you know, they were kind of Christian, But, you know, and then you went over to Catholic and then you got to like
Presbyterian.
Yeah, and Mormon was a cult.
I wasn't aware of how dogmatic we were, because I had such the fun, poppy Christian culture kind of youth, teenage experience. So I loved it. So I wanted more of it. I wanted to do that. I mean, that's a part of I went to seminary was, you know, that's how I youth group years and college ministry years and thought that's what ministry would be like.
Where you lived, were most of the other kids Baptist, or at least your friends were Baptist? Were you, would you say you were in a bubble of sort of evangelical Christianity?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I had that, I had that pretty significant group of Catholic friends, but we never talked about church and we weren't all that close. And I remember one week, my mom has passed away, so I can say this and she won't, she might come back and haunt me, but she won't listen to this, so I don't have to worry too much about it. But I remember one week, my mom was going to sing in the revival choir. There was a revival in town. And they had a choir that anybody in the community could come join. And so I was going to go with her to this revival. And I had a friend over. So I was like, hey, I want to bring my friend to this event. And she kind of made a face. I knew she wasn't wild about it. I didn't know why. I thought, you know, revivals are where you're supposed to take friends.
Right. Of course.
Who are heathens. And he was a Catholic. So, of course, that's what we all thought.
Right.
And so I took this friend. And it was a very emotional, highly evangelical kind of revival service. And of course he wanted to make a profession of faith. And all I remember my mom saying was, I knew that would happen. Like, with such disdain, like, you know, no sense of hope or joy. Well,
did she
or anything.
Think that she was going to get in trouble, like with his parents or something?
Yeah, I'm sure she did. I'm sure that was part of it. But you know, that was outside of our bubble. Our bubble was, you know, when we talk about anything that matters, it's from the Southern Baptist perspective. That's sure. how we viewed everything.
Sure. And would you say that the churches you grew up in, because as you well know, you know, there's spectrum, you know, within Baptist life, and there was when we were growing up. Would you say they were on the moderate side of things, or would you say they were more conservative leaning fundamentalist side of things?
Yeah, definitely more conservative leaning fundamentalist. Mm-hmm. That was true for the church I was born into, that my parents and grandparents had gone to for, I don't know if I would say generations, but for a long time. And then we moved around a little. You know, our generation moved around as jobs changed, Gen Xers.
Right.
The economy was what it was. And so we went to different churches. Most of them were, they were all still Southern Baptist, and most of them were still pretty conservative to fundamentalist. We did end up at one for a few years that I later found out it was more moderate, but that only meant that some of the ministers there, it just meant the ministers weren't all on the same page.
Yeah.
Around some of their theology. The church wasn't moderate. They weren't ordaining women. It wasn't that progressive. But there were at least a few ministers who 5 years later ended up in what became the CBF. But at the time, the pastor of that church was a little more moderate.
Right.
Most of the people didn't know. We just assumed it was the same kind of Southern Baptist church. You know, we sang the same songs and
sure.
prayed the same prayers.
Had you the did same the same Sunday communion. School same Sunday school curriculum from the
Absolutely.
Sunday school board. You know, yeah.
Exactly.
Well, so, all right, how was Baylor thought of? Was Baylor thought of as liberal, or was it thought of as the jewel in the Texas Baptist crown? How did your family and your background view you going to Baylor?
It was a little bit more the jewel in mm-hmm. the Texas Baptist crown. There was a little fear that there might be some liberalism at Baylor. In the religion department of all places.
Of course, right.
But by and large, people didn't see Baylor that way. And that's still true today. I mean, Baylor is still kind of the jewel of Texas
right.
Baptist life. And it's still not seen as a hotbed of liberalism. It's still seen, people still assume it's a pretty conservative place. And it is by and large. I mean, it's not a fundamentalist school. I mean, it's definitely a moderate Baptist school.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Texas has always liked to call itself moderate, but then wants to be as right-leaning as possible.
Sure.
And that's kind of how Baylor has always probably felt to me.
Mm-hmm. And, well, we'll get to how do you be a dean of the School of Social Work at a Baptist school later. But all right, by the time I knew you in seminary, you were like had piercings and would regularly, you know, be wearing eyeshadow just to freak people out and, you know, very pronounced
right.
in your left-leaning beliefs and
right,
politics.
Right.
What would be the right words to describe your clothing? Not, you weren't goth, but you were definitely like, in what would have been in the 90s, still called alternative. Now,
right.
did all that persona begin at your time at Baylor, or did it happen after your time at Baylor? And
at Baylor. It was just countercultural at Baylor. I mean, Baylor is where, so Baylor flipped a switch for me intellectually that
okay.
I never experienced in high school. I mean, I was a, mm-hmm. You know, top 10% kind of a student, but I read as little as possible. I did as little work as possible. I did just enough to try to prove to people I was in the top 10%. But
yes.
I was never an avid reader. Still not really an avid reader. Not that strong of a student. I got into Baylor, but Baylor did flip a switch, particularly in the humanities and philosophy and theology. And it just gave me a whole different way to think about my faith and the world. And mm-hmm. I didn't know what to do with it. Like, I didn't know how to talk about it to family. I didn't know how to I didn't know how to reconcile what I was learning with what I was experiencing at church, and the way that they, you know, the way the church expected people to look and live. I just thought that's not what Jesus would want. And in the alternative 90s, that meant I was going to grow my hair. And, well, if I wasn't going to wear Birkenstocks, then I was going to wear Doc Martens. And
so there you go.
It was just a countercultural. And there was a little bit of that at Baylor. You know, there was this little bit of counterculturalism. And I found that group because we could have these conversations.
Sure.
About the big questions that I never got to ask at church.
I would say I had a similar experience, you know, going to a Baptist college and went to Carson Newman. It was in the classroom that I discovered intellectual freedom. It was the first place I felt like I could ask the sort of questions that I knew I shouldn't ask in church growing up and not feel judged for it. And it was exciting to feel like there was another world, but also the professors were very kind and nurturing. They didn't approach us with condescension, these conservative Baptist kids. They were nurturing and they exposed us to things, but then helped us wrestle with it and helped us understand we weren't alone. You know, they had wrestled with it too. And it wasn't just like they dropped a bomb on us and then left us to, you know, pull together the scraps of what had been our faith.
Absolutely. And in time, I realized that's what I wanted to do. That's what I wanted to be, was help other people in that same journey.
Yeah.
So that was exactly my Baylor experience, was I love that I could ask these questions. They weren't trying to impose this radically different belief system. They were just encouraging us to wonder aloud how God is at work. And we could start from where we were. So we started with the assumptions we had always heard. And they would just ask kind questions of, so what does that mean for you? And let's think through that together and tell me why and how. I'm like, well, I've never been asked why or how. It just is what it is. And it was, you know, I never felt imposed upon, but just the freedom to ask things help me begin to see the world differently.
Right. Yeah, I definitely identify with that. And I think that's a gift of that kind of school, is it's not just going to college and then you're hit with so much and you begin to view, you know, being a person of faith as something you grow out of.
Right.
But rather helping you to go deeper, much deeper.
And Baylor has always really paid attention to the concept of vocation. And you know, I experienced that. And it wasn't about finding a job, and it wasn't about vocation as ministry. It was just, what is your life's call? What does it mean to even be called? What does it mean for God to be at work in our life in a meaningful way? So to continue to do that today, hopefully I can offer that same gift to students that Baylor offered to me.
Yeah. Well, and you've been at it long enough now, 17 years. That means you could have students that are mid late 30s now. I mean,
I have students teaching for me that were in my classes.
Oh, wow.
Fun.
What a legacy. And then you go to seminary, and how I described going to Baptist Theological Seminary at Richmond to people who don't have a Baptist connection. As I say, this is at the time where the refugees went.
Right. Right.
You know, within a few years, there were like 89 new Baptist divinity schools out there across the South. But at the time, you either could go to Truett at Baylor or you could go to BTSR. But if you were getting off the fundamentalist takeover train, you only had two stops, one or the other.
Yeah. And I felt like BTSR was the better option at the time. I mean, having been at Baylor, I left right before Truett started. So I didn't, you know, nobody had experienced Truett. But from what I was hearing, I had a little fear that Truett would feel a little too much like Southwestern. And I felt like the East Coast and the people who had left Southern could maybe nurture a little bit more of the openness that I was, that I'd come to experience and wanted more of.
I think for me, I already, going to Texas seemed like going to another planet, I would say.
Yeah,
and,
sure.
You know, my family was in Richmond and that kind of thing. But how do you look back on that seminary, our beloved seminary, which is now closed? For me, going from BTSR to Emory, where I was, you know, TAing and even teaching in a divinity school, Methodist, but it was still many people from many different denominations were there. And then also being a student, a doctoral student in the graduate division of religion, how I ended up feeling was I had an inadequate seminary education. And I'm really grateful for the friends I made. I'm grateful for the faculty and that sort of thing. But I really felt like a fish, like that's not the rest of the wrong metaphor. I fell out of my league at Emory. And you know, and felt like, oh, when I was walking around the halls of Candler and sitting in classes, I was like, this is what seminary could have been? Wow. Do you have any feeling like that? Or is that just me because I'm a jerk?
No, absolutely. I even felt that a little bit then.
Mm-hmm.
I remember being at the library with students from Union and thinking, you guys are talking at a little bit different level.
Yeah.
It feels a little more intimidating to me. And I just didn't know what to talk it up to. Still, I mean, I visited Duke and it felt too much for me, or too big or something for this little Southern Baptist boy. So all I could fathom was getting out of Texas and going to BTSR. That was as big as I could step out of my bubble.
Sure.
But still at BTSR, I felt a little protected, a little too insular. It was a little too insular, theologically maybe, and academically.
Yeah.
Particularly when compared to what people were talking about at Union.
Sure. My undergrad at Carson Newman, the people that went to Duke or Princeton or Candler were all people that were going to go into academics. Like that, you know, that was the perception I had. If you went to a divinity school, if you were going into academics, if you felt a call to ministry, you'd go to a seminary. I learned later that was not the case, but that was the perception I had.
Right.
I don't think I could have made a different choice. The 22-year-old me, like that was the only option I could understand. But in hindsight, I look back and think there were real limitations to where we went. And I don't mean to be too harsh. I just mean to say.
And I get that that's probably more true for you than it was for me, because you did go into religious higher education. And I made the shift over to the social sciences.
Mm-hmm.
And so seminary didn't prepare me for anything in the social sciences, except for some critical thinking. So I did, you know, partly from Baylor and partly from seminary, I did develop just enough critical thinking to be able to make the leap to social work, where I could figure out kind of their worldview and how their approach to research and their philosophy of science and their kind of way of doing academics worked.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe it's just because I had enough graduate school experience, but I think it was different not being in a religious graduate school program.
Well, all right. And I want to go back to seminary, because my memories of you in seminary were having, you know, the theology professor, Elizabeth Barnes, miss a class and asking you to sit in and teach the class for her. You know, and so I always felt like you were in at a deeper level. I mean, you seem to me to be actually reading the theologians and the ethicists and that kind of thing that our textbooks were referencing, and you were actually like going to the source material and reading the real stuff. Was I wrong and you were just good at pretending like you knew stuff?
I really was. I mean, that was the one area where I really did care about the content. I didn't do that in my New Testament Bible classes. I didn't do that in ethics or philosophy, but the theology, I really did. I was just so struck by the big questions of our faith, the big questions of who God is and how God is at work in the world and what that even means, that I did read those sources. And I love to talk to Elizabeth about those things. And I love to be able to talk about it in a class. And that's where, and a part of it was kind of discerning vocation. That's where I thought, I can do this.
Yes.
I'm not here to be a minister in the traditional sense. I'm here to do this.
Right.
And so the fact that she nurtured that in me and gave me the opportunity to teach, I remember the first time she asked me to teach, I said no. And I went and told Wendy, and Wendy's like, "You crazy? That's that's a great fit for you. It's a great opportunity for you." So I called her back, kind of ate crow, and said, "Dr. Barnes, I'm sorry, this is John again. Is that offer still good? My wife says I should do it." she was very kind. She said, "Of course you can do it." So I was grateful to her, grateful to Dr. Barnes, but also grateful to be in a school that still, you know, promoted thinking this kind of a way. So even though there were some things I didn't love about BTSR not quite being broad enough, at that point, I really thought I would do more grad school in theology. And I mean, at that point, I wasn't thinking I would do social work. I didn't know what social work was.
Yeah.
I wanted to do social justice theology, liberation theology kinds of things. And honestly, I couldn't get into a graduate program. And in part because BTSR didn't prepare us. Yes. And I was so jealous of you that you got into one. And I applied to 7 and got into 0. And I applied to 1 PhD program in social work and got into that one. And
I don't think I knew that. I think that I don't think I knew that.
I don't think I told anyone. I know that's where I was, you know, it was a prideful 3 on the Enneagram. I did not tell anybody that. But it was painful.
Well, it is painful. I applied everywhere and only got into 3. The 3 I got into, I was not the first pick of any of them. Like, I was in the, when they didn't get who they wanted. They didn't get who they wanted, the they called me back. Right. I was on the wait list. And I would say I was definitely not prepared for doctoral work. And instead of buckling down and working harder, I just suffered with my insecurity and felt like a poser the whole time. And and didn't take advantage of the opportunity like I should have. But that's a different, we're not interviewing me.
It's a different podcast.
So why did you even apply to VCU, Virginia Commonwealth University? Why even do that if you wanted theology?
So I thought that, I mean, I know some people had done an MA in theology. I knew that some people after their MDiv would do like a 1-year MA to help get them a little more of an academic credential before they did a PhD. And when I heard about people doing that, I thought, well, okay, but maybe a different kind of degree would be helpful. And in part, I didn't think I had the chops to go across the street to Union and do their 1-year MA. Oh. And another school in town was VCU, but I didn't know anything about social work. And I can't remember the name of the guy who did student services. You don't have to say his name if you can remember. But I remember a guy that we worked with at the seminary said, well, you know, next year is your final year. You have to do your internship. Most internships are in churches. What church do you want to go to? And I remember thinking, I am not going to do another internship in a church. I did that in college. I've done youth ministry and college ministry. I don't want to preach. I'm not going to do it. I don't know what else I'm going to do, but I don't want to do a church internship. And he said, well, if you go to social work, you can do something in the community. If that's what you're more passionate about, why don't you go do that? I was like, okay, fine. I don't know what social work is, but if I can do, you know, if it's about social service and community service and social justice, then I'll look into it. And I fell in love with it. And I really thought, oh, I can learn some more practical skills besides just preaching. Mm-hmm. And I can get another master's degree that will maybe help me get into that theology PhD program. Practical skills, but I didn't get into the PhD program.
And the way that worked was you added a year on and got a combined MDiv and MA?
MSW.
Oh, it was your MSW. Okay. And then you decided to go on and get the PhD.
Yeah, so I fell in love with it. I went from not knowing what it was to a year later thinking, okay, maybe these are the kinds of questions that can nurture me academically. What is at the root of these social problems, and what role does religion play in both exacerbating these problems and maybe addressing them? And if I can't do that in a PhD program in religion, I couldn't get into an ethics program or a theology program, and I didn't know what practical theology programs were, but it was the same thing. Then I thought, okay, maybe a PhD in social work would still open doors for higher ed teaching jobs, which is what I wanted. Even though I didn't feel like I would love teaching social work, it was still a pathway to a PhD in teaching jobs. And I really had this some sense of a vocation of teaching.
And I'm fascinated that, you know, we have these hinge moments in our lives where in the moment we don't even realize it. But you kind of had a conversation that guided you towards what you knew what you didn't want. You didn't know what you wanted, but you knew what you didn't want.
Right.
And then that ends up like you end up becoming, you know, on a path that takes you to being the dean of the social work school of Baylor. I mean, that's
bizarre.
What were the questions that were driving you? What were the questions? You said the big social ills or whatever, but what, you'd been studying theology and getting jazzed on that, and then suddenly you're in the field of social work. What were these questions that excited you?
You know, I was joking earlier about the countercultural stuff. This, you know, these were the days of HIV and AIDS. And
sure.
I took a pastoral care class, and we had to do some kind of volunteer work as part of that class. And I did mine at the Richmond AIDS Ministry in their HIV hospice.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the place where I began to really ask, where is God in this?
Mm-hmm.
And I felt like seminary could only do so much to help me figure a way through. I was just enough of a pragmatist. I mean, that's where I also realized I'm not really a philosopher. I'm a pragmatist as a theologian, I'm more of a pragmatist than a true academic theologian philosopher. I wanted to know what is wrong with our country that we're letting people die from this disease in this way and judging their sexuality as a result. And I just couldn't fathom the church was silent, except for everyone outside of Baptist life. I mean, the Episcopals were right there running these programs.
Right,
and
right.
The Catholic Church was involved, and the Presbyterian Church was involved, and you couldn't find a Baptist anywhere.
Right.
And I remember feeling less than, I remember feeling a little bit of judgment, and I remember trying to cover it up with my, you know, being academic. Well, that didn't work. Those people didn't care about me being academic. They're dying of HIV.
And, right.
And that was a part of the shift to social work. Social work has skills for how to make a difference, not only in the lives of individuals, but socially. We know how to ask societal questions about promoting social justice and changing social policy. And that was as much part of what piqued my interest in anything. And I still thought I would apply it to the church, which I have.
Sure.
So that was
absolutely.
That was at the heart of a lot of my interest was, okay, I want to take this social work and do it in the church or in religious organizations. And I remember in the school of social work, that was foreign to them. There was one woman who was Methodist who ended up being my advisor, and another woman who was Catholic who ended up being my dissertation advisor. And they kind of nurtured me through this. They also happened to know Diana Garland. Who had just left Southern to go to Baylor.
Right.
I didn't know Diana, but I kind of got to know her through them, actually. So
wait a second. I have to stop you. I always figured that you connected with Diana Garland, who groomed you to be her successor, okay, at the school. That's my perception of things, okay?
Right.
I don't know whether that's true or not. That's certainly diminishing you. I don't mean to diminish your effort.
No, it's true. She did.
But I always figured that you connected with Diana Ireland, dean of the School of Social Work. It was the big deal when Southern Seminary, you know, punted the Carver, Carver School of Social Work. It just said, get rid of all that liberal, non-biblical crap. And it goes to Baylor. So this was a huge deal. And I always figured you connected with her via other Southern Seminary refugees. But you're telling me it was through your folks in the VCU social work program. Wow.
Yeah. Okay. I mean, Bill Rogers knew her. Glenn Henson knew her. Sam Ballantyne knew her. All of our BTSR people knew the Garlands. But they didn't. And they knew I was studying social work. But none of them connected the dots. It was two professors at VCU who said, you're from Baylor, you're a Baptist, and you're doing social work, you should meet Diana.
Wow.
And I remember thinking, I don't know who she is, but I know Southern. And so it made sense to reach out to her.
Right.
And then that's how I got to Baylor. And then she did start grooming me from that point. So you're right. It took a little longer for me to
What seems ironic to me is, out of friends from seminary, if I had to guess at that time in our lives, who was going to burst out of the Baptist bubble and just keep going on a trajectory away?
Right, right.
You would have been the number one in my list.
And yet you did it.
I know. It's really
did it.
It's Lincoln bizarre.
Did it. Everybody but me.
Right. And it's bizarre. I mean, I'm kind of like, all people, you ended up back in like the heart of Baptist life at Baylor University, in some sense, full circle. And when we were in seminary together, you would have been the last person who I would have thought would have ended up that way.
Well, it was not by conscious choice or intention. Mm-hmm. I was on my way out. My last... once I graduated BTSR, I kind of walked away from Baptist life for a little while. Wendy actually stayed at Northminster, and I had an opportunity to work with a Church of the Brethren that was in Richmond, and a small Mennonite church.
Right.
I ended up pastoring the Mennonite church the last 3 years I was there as my exit strategy. And lo and behold, if those morons were not asking the same questions the same way that we were. They were still trying to figure out, how do we keep the gaze away, and how do we not let women get too carried away, and how do we make sure to protect our power and privilege? And I was like, you've got to be kidding me. This is the denomination of peace and justice, and you can't do any better? I still wasn't intending to come back to Baptist life. That still felt backwards. I was getting ready to make the next step towards Episcopal life or Catholic life. One of my internships in social work was with the Jesuits in Richmond at a Catholic center, community house kind of place in South Richmond. And so I thought, okay, I'll leave the Mennonites have been good to me, but I'll just work with the Jesuits. I remember talking to Linda Bridges about it, and Linda described the journey of a dolphin who lives in the water but has to come out for breath and then returns back in. And she said, maybe you're making your way from one body of water to the next, but maybe this is just a season where you've come out to catch your breath.
Wow.
And that analogy totally stuck. And then I met Diana, and Diana essentially kind of brought me back into the water that was my home. And I've really made a peace with Baptist life.
Now, that's amazing.
I don't always love being Baptist, but there's enough diversity in Baptist. I mean, I'm still connected to the Alliance.
Right.
I still have wrestled with the CBF over the years, and still am perpetually mad at the SBC. But I've still kind of found my way of doing Baptist life, and Baylor has kind of let me do that.
Which is great, considering you've had Ken Starr as a president of your university.
Exactly. Well, luckily he was Church of Christ, so he didn't know.
Yeah, so he didn't understand Baptist.
He was definitely more conservative theologically than a lot of us on campus, and otherwise, to say the least. But But he kind of let us do our thing in Soul's Work. He loved Diana. Huh. And for better or worse, anybody who loved Diana ended up loving me because she just went around saying I was the little Diana. And so he was actually really good to me.
Well, that's great. Over the years, when you've connected, you have described, and I can edit this out, okay, if you don't want it on the record. You've said to me that if you were one of the religion professors, you would be under constant scrutiny in dealing with crap all the time from outside the university and stuff. But because you're the school of social work, that the religious powers that be down in Texas just sort of dismiss you as they're doing hippie stuff anyway, so whatever. Do you feel like that you aren't even thought of in the same way as, say, the religion department at Baylor is thought of?
Or the seminary, for that matter.
Mm-hmm.
I really think that's true, and I think my colleagues in those schools would probably agree with that. Mm-hmm. They kind of have to keep their head down in a way that I don't. We are preparing people for the profession of social work as our primary goal. That's the mission of our School of Social Work. And so they, of course, our board, our president, our provost, of course, is going to honor that. And they expect us to do what social workers do. And they know it's a progressive profession focused on caring for the most vulnerable in society. And while we wrestle with the politics and the economics of how to do that and our capitalist economy, they still say, good for you as a social worker for showing up to these conversations and wrestling with these kinds of things. As a religion professor, I don't think I would be able to approach the conversations the same way. I think they would ask me different questions about, well, is that what the Bible says you should be doing? And it's like I get a pass as a social worker in a sense. Mm-hmm. Now, it's not a pass from my faith. And in fact, I feel like I can argue that, and I do, that what we are doing is not just social work. It is social work, and it's very traditional social work in a lot of ways, but it's social work that is reflective of our faith and motivated by our faith. And so even if they don't ask me questions about how does this align with your faith, I'm always pretty quick to tell them we are doing this because this is what Jesus would ask us to do. This is the narrative of what God is doing throughout Scripture. So we are continuing that legacy of working for justice and caring for the poor and the vulnerable. And then it's like we can be honored for what we contribute in the life of the university.
Well, I'm glad because things have become so utterly polarized and political in our nation. I mean, even more so than 20 years ago. I'm glad you aren't immediately dismissed as, oh, you're blue state, bleeding heart liberal crap, and that you aren't outright dismissed. I think that must be a credit to the university culture at Baylor.
Well, it is, but also I think they probably don't see us as that much of a threat. You know, they probably feel like, okay, we can keep doing a part of what we're doing, and you can challenge us, but, I mean, we did that years ago when we were trying to create a living wage movement on campus. They were like, thank you for that contribution. That is a great idea. Thank you for speaking your mind and your faith. However, our economy says this is what we are going to pay people. And I'm like, oh, okay, well, thank you for that. So sometimes we get that around other kinds of things. You know, we can support our LGBT students a little more freely than we could several years ago. You know, but there's also the message of, within our mission, we can only take that so far. And I'm always asking the question, okay, but what does that mean and why and how?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, it makes me glad you're there and that you're continuing to push at those boundaries for the kids that are coming there, the students, not just kids, but adults that are coming there.